Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this program. We've got a great show coming up for you tonight. We're going to be talking a little bit more in depth about austere medicine in certain areas of the country where we don't have all the resources and things are a little more spread out. We'll have more about that later on in this episode. But before we get to that and everything else, remind you to check out our site at disasterpodcast.com, where you'll find links to me and, of course, to my great co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, how are you?
Oh, thanks, Jamie. I'm just fine. It's actually been a little bit cooler. I think we're leaning into fall out here in California, but it's pretty warm today. But we're going to talk about a place that isn't always so warm, so I can't wait to do that because it's one of my favorite states and someplace I'd really like to spend more time. But, of course, we have one of our constant guests and favorite people, Dr. Joe Hawley. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Sam. Hi, Jamie. Great to have you guys be on with you guys again.
It's great to be on with you, and I know you've got us hooked up with a guest tonight to talk about our austere medical environment topic.
Well, I do indeed, Jamie, and I'm really pleased to introduce a great friend and a phenomenal doc, Mike Levy. Mike works with in Alaska with EMS there, and he and I have known each other for quite a while, but he's got some really amazing information and awesome stories about sort of austere medicine in the Alaska wilderness, if you will. And so, Mike, we're so glad to have you on the program tonight. And say hello.
Yes, I can. Thanks a lot for having me. Good to be here. Thanks to Jamie. Thanks to Joe. Thanks to Sam. Appreciate it.
It's great having you with us, Mike, and we do appreciate that. You know, it's been a lot of things going on with, you know, close cramped quarters and people talking about Ebola and other things in the eastern United States where everybody lives close together. But where you're from out there in Alaska, folks are a little more spread out and the concerns are different in areas like that. Why don't you describe a little bit about the area in which you and your EMS teams work?
I'd love to. Let me just make a parenthetical there that even as far away as we are immersed in the Ebola event as well. So we don't get a pass being where we are.
That's frightening to hear, Mike.
thank you. Yes, I think we'd all agree with that. So I work in Anchorage, Alaska, which is the population center of Alaska, population of going on about 300,000 versus a total population in our large state, right at about 700,000 souls. And the work I have in Anchorage is largely the same as in any other urban center. Anchorage itself kind of sits in, call it a crescent, ringed by the inlet and mountains on the other side. So although we have jurisdiction within the mountains around us, most of our calls in the Anchorage area is an urban response. Having said that, some of the responses we have in that urban area has to do with the large population of moose and bear that we have here as well. So we do have encounters that would be a little unusual for most places in an urban environment. I also have had a lot of experience. I came up here in the Native Health Service, National Health Corps, and so I had experience then, and then I've had extensive experience as a medical director for flight services, civilian medical sponsor for the 210th, then the 212th paramedic squadron with the Alaska Air National Guard and various other things. So I think I probably have a few things I can line out for you that we've seen up here.
Mike, one thing I noticed,
great, Mike.
I want to...
I'm sorry, go ahead, Sam.
No, I was just going to say, I've had one opportunity to go to Anchorage, and I absolutely loved it. The irony was we went up there to do a federal exercise in the cold winter conditions, and even though it was cold to us, all the Alaskans are running around in T-shirts and shorts, so that was kind of my indication that it wasn't all that cold. One of the things I noticed in some of the places we went, you guys have a very different mode of transportation up there, especially as it gets much more rural. pretty much everybody has a plane or has access to one, because for a lot of those areas, that's the only way you can get in or out. Is that just what they're showing on TV, Mike?
That's absolutely true. Anchorage has, I believe, the largest float plane lake, or that is controlled by a control tower, maybe any place on the planet. And I also believe it's true that there's more licensed pilots in Alaska per capita than any other place. Planes are very much a part of what we do up here.
Yeah,
so, Mike, this is Joe. Could you talk a little bit about kind of, you know, I can appreciate that the challenges in Anchorage might not be too significant from a sort of a more standard and, you know, continental U.S. EMS response. But some of the challenges of folks who are outside the urban environment there in Anchorage, and you know, some of the issues that you deal with in managing folks in that extreme austere environment.
Sure. So I think it's good if anybody is kind of an Alaskaphile to grab a picture on the internet sometime. That's different than what we grew up with in school, the one where Alaska is situated right down by Baja California next to Hawaii, and look at it, how it actually lays out on a map of the continental United States. And when you do, you'll see that it starts up at the tip of Minnesota, and Panhandle goes down to about Jacksonville, Florida, and then our Aleutians would trail out all the way to San Diego, San Francisco area. So it's a big chunk of land. I think most of us in EMS, largely in our quick responses, look to rotor wing as an approach to get things done quickly. We have some limited helicopter use in the Anchorage area, but you know, when you look at the service use of a typical helicopter, and then you look at where we need to go, that helicopter has limited abilities in terms of making the whole distance. So we use a lot of fixed wing transport to get out to where we need to go to help people.
Whatever works. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I was just going to say, so you know, we've talked a lot in the past about sort of how disaster medicine is fairly unique in that there's a significant time delay element involved in most of that. And it strikes me that in Alaska, you deal with that a lot just on almost an everyday EMS basis, simply because the travel distances may be extreme, the ability to get access to EMS may be very delayed in many cases. And I'm fascinated by sort of on a day-to-day basis, what sort of unique and unusual, I guess, and sort of unconventional changes or approaches have you had to make in order to address those delays that are just simply inherent in the system because you're covering such a vast amount of territory?
Right. And then as everybody, probably people on this cast are pretty sophisticated in terms of just because you want to get somewhere doesn't mean you're going to get there. We not only have distances, but we have some pretty snotty weather sometimes. And so the places we want to get to a lot of the time are out on the Aleutian chain or, you know, in areas where really you fly when you can fly. In terms of interesting things, I think one of the biggest things we've come to conclude here is that the golden hour for us often becomes the golden day or the golden 2 days. And it's sometimes pretty amazing the kind of injuries people sustain and manage to survive. I think that's been sort of an eye-opener for us here in Alaska. We can't do anything about it, and so we just, you know, make arrangements and try to get people in, and it's kind of amazing how some pretty seriously injured people survive a lot longer than you think they would in austere conditions.
They're obviously a tough bunch. You know, and that makes me wonder how, when you're in the, and I was going to ask you generically, how does your methods of transportation and your challenges change from season to season? But, you know, I noticed watching some of these shows about Alaska that you have these little pockets of people that are way out there and basically cut off from civilization as we know it in the winter. I mean, do they have anybody locally that can manage, like you were saying, they manage, just seem to manage until, you know, ALS or whatever else, or transportation can get there, but do they have people that are medically trained generally in these small communities?
Right, and that's a great question. When we talk about Alaskan medicine, we go beyond what we're talking about rural medicine. We talk about remote medicine, and we look at remote medicine as that area that we practice in where there are no roads. And if you, again, look at a map of Alaska, there are roads in a very small portion of Alaska. South Central Alaska, where I live, has a road system that goes a certain distance, and Southeast has roads that go a certain distance. But, for example, you can't get to our nation, our state's capital by road. You have to fly or take a boat. And when you look at the little villages, like you were talking about, of 50, 100 people, they can be 100% isolated, particularly in the summer, because of water. So the only way you can get there is by boat or plane. In the wintertime, when things freeze up, you then get a highway on the ice. So then snow machine, even vehicles can travel on that. So there are these significant differences that we have in Alaska. We've come up with some interesting solutions to them, which includes the Community Health Aid Program. Have you guys heard of that?
No, we haven't. I think you should go ahead and let us know about it.
Well, you know, when you look at mobile integrated health care, you look at community practice paramedicine, great ideas and the applicability of that, we're starting to sort out and seeing a lot of opportunities. Up here in Alaska for, certainly more than two decades, they've had a thing through the Native Health Service to train essentially barefoot doctors. So these are people without advanced degrees, most of the time I believe a high school degree, but maybe not, who are trained in a multi-part process to be kind of the boots on the ground in the villages. So the Community Health Aid is trained through a rigorous program to do physical assessments and report back to a covering doctor who they send faxes to or the like. But basically, they do initiate therapy for ear infections, sore throats, upper respiratory symptoms. And honestly, they're the ones that have to first attend the big traumas we see way out in the villages. So they get trauma training as well, and they do the very best they can, and oftentimes a very, very good job in terms of stabilizing severely injured, severely sick people until we can get planes out to pick them up.
Mike, that makes me wonder, when we talk about community medicine, they talk about the potential of maybe having that offline doc that can be, you know, you can get them on an iPad or get them on a computer and show them an injury with the camera and those kinds of things. But do they even have internet access in those areas to make something like that possible?
Right. So there is a system of telemedicine, but, you know, I have my own opinion about that, and it certainly is not endorsed by anyone besides me necessarily, so I wouldn't want that to be misinterpreted. But the idea of doing anything that is not store and forward in telehealth applications, to me, is kind of wrought with problems. And so, by and large, I think that EMS provides a really good platform for using protocols, teaching people to have judgment, but giving them the latitude to act operationally to the situation. And then we get indirect control sometimes, sometimes we don't. And I think, you know, really that's pretty much how it works out in the community health aides as well. They have direct oversight, but given limitations of phones and availability of a covering physician, you know, just different agencies, they make it work based on some protocols as well.
So, Mike, understanding that you know, these folks are working in very remote circumstances, do the medics in those situations have sort of an enhanced skill set? Do they have additional procedures or protocols, as it were, that are sort of above and beyond the normal stuff that we would expect in order to allow them to be able to take care of a patient who may be 2 days away from sort of definitive medical care?
Yeah, you know, they absolutely do. That's kind of a long, multi-branching story regarding different sorts of things we have to do up here. But in terms of, for example, the flight medics, usually our teams up here are flight medic nurse teams, and so they have extensive latitude to react to the situation they find. And so much of the time, there can be no direct medical control, even though we often, we have sat phones in the planes and the like. It's been my experience, they work when you don't really need them, and they don't work when you need them in terms of actually communicating. So people have to have the latitude and the training to use drugs and use interventions that you wouldn't typically use in an urban setting.
Can you give us an example of that, Mike, of types of protocols that are expanded for that kind of use?
Sure. For example, and again, this is kind of tied into the idea of having the nurse and the paramedic on the team in terms of just licensure issues and the like. But use of antibiotics, for example. We often have medics who administer antibiotics basically offline because of the lack of ability to immediately contact in a situation where a person is quite sick or transporting somebody with a open belly wound or something like that. So we've been able to do training as well as do things called side letters and expanded scope letters up here to allow for a variety basically interventions and drugs that are not standard of care in usual scope of practice.
Mike, what about your facility setup? I know Anchorage is probably like most urban hospital. The hospital setup would be much like other large cities down here. But what do you have in those remote areas? Do they have to go all the way into Anchorage if they're from one of these really remote areas, or do you have like lower level hospitals scattered about?
Yeah, well, that's a great statement. So a couple of just statistics is that about 3/4 of all Alaska communities can't be reached by road.
Wow.
Over the state, we have 24 acute care hospitals, but 14 of those have less than 50 beds. And in the Anchorage and Mat-Su areas, which is where the population base is, that's actually where 6 of those hospitals are of the entire cadre. So the rest of them are scattered out across the across the state. So we have these clinics at the population areas that are what are called, we have hospitals, and then we have what are called sub-regional clinics, and then we have village health clinics. So that's kind of the way that the tree branches out in the bush. So, for example, in the YK Delta, in the area where Bethel, Alaska is, population of there, this is an absolutely a swag, so please don't hold me to this, but let's say there's as many as 10,000 people in the YK Delta. In Bethel itself, it's probably not more than a few thousand, and then they're scattered over a number of little villages. So you have the hospital, then you have these sub-regional clinics. I think there's 3 of them or so. And then there's the village health clinic, which is basically just a little shop, a little thing in the village itself, staffed by the health aide.
Wow. So what kind of expertise are in these, not necessarily your little health clinics, but in that next level up, the more regional clinics? Is that a physician and nurse staff? Do they have any level of surgery or anything like that there?
Yeah, typically at the sub-regional clinic level, and I haven't been in that situation for some time, so I don't want to talk out of school. I think the staffing is somewhat variable. It'll often be staffed by physicians, and it's usually from the public health service, the native health service, and so people either get rotated in there in some cases. People from Anchorage, often part of your role was to fly out and do clinics out at the remote hospitals or the sub-regional clinics. The ability to provide care at a sub-regional clinic is... I'm sure simple IMDs and stuff like that, but typically not any surgery. At one of the hospitals, such as the Bethel Hospital, they actually do have surgeons that are there for clinics, and I believe some minor surgeries are certainly performed there. The they actually at Bethel Hospital and Nome have CAT scans now, have CT scanners. So,
cool.
Yeah, so that has provided probably a benefit on balance. I mean, when we have our tests, you know, we find more stuff, so I say on balance. But we flew a lot of people out for head injuries, as you might imagine, based on the lack of having a CT scan. And once you have the comfort of knowing there's no bleed or shift, then you can keep a person in a more remote area sometimes.
What percentage of the population is native still up there? I sense a lot more than most people probably realize.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Probably I should have the answer to that. I don't.
I caught you on that one, didn't I?
You got me. If you look out in the villages, you know, certainly there's a much higher proportion of native Alaskans in the villages. When you get into the urban areas, I'm going to tell you it's 15% in the Anchorage area, and I don't think that's too far off, but it might be. But that's my recollection. So that's another, that's what we call a wild arse gas there, but that was my recollection.
Yeah, it gives us an idea. So I don't want to jump. Joe, you're sitting out there quietly. If you got questions, pop in. I'm just so fascinated with this, I could keep going.
Well, I was actually just sitting here thinking that, you know, it's fascinating on a couple different levels. First of all, it strikes me that Mike practices a version, if you will, of disaster medicine all the time, and it's a version of disaster medicine in that there are extensive time delays and extensive access delays. They're just a day-to-day occurrence for him. So from a disaster medicine standpoint, you know, Mike is a supreme expert. He does it every single day. It's just a normal day for him. But it also strikes me that while most of the rest of the country is looking at and working on the concept of community paramedicine, Mike's been doing it for 20 years. It's just a normal part of his practice. And so I think in many ways the country ought to look to Alaska in an awful lot of ways to see a model that's been in place and working very efficiently and very effectively for quite a long time already.
That makes perfect sense.
And I think that just shows that model works in one place, and it can be adapted. It's one of the things that when I look at community paramedicine programs, and I've been doing that for quite some time on my various shows, that they're all adapted to the community's needs specifically. And Alaska has done that as well. They've done it first, and they've done it, it sounds like, exceedingly well, so that the system does a good job for them and is something that should be held up for other areas to look at and see how adapted of these situations, you know, an EMS community presence can be. Just so you know, thanks to the U.S. Census Bureau, the Alaska Native American Indian population in Alaska is 14.7% as of the last census.
You're good.
Oh.
So just thought I'd let you know we do have that information to back you up there, Mike.
Yeah, thanks. I knew that, but thanks for that.
Jamie's magic computer always helps, too.
I don't know how much you want to dwell on this, but I will expand slightly. I think that if you look at the Alaska model for, you know, what we're now looking at as community practice paramedicine in a way, you have to have things coalesce, right? I mean, and again, usually it comes down to, and I hate to be this gross, but I think it comes down to follow the money a lot of the time. And so as we try to roll out community practice paramedicine, you know, everybody has to figure out what the economics of it is. So if you flip back over to where I'm at, people everything has to have a transition, but there isn't any controversy now about community health aids providing the care they do in their communities. And you know, it's a simple fact. You cannot afford to put physicians or mid-level practitioners out there, nor do they really want to go. And so this is a hugely cost-effective and demonstrably great way to provide health care. And there's absolutely no reason, if you just look at the provision of health care, that the medics that we know couple of them probably on the line here, could provide that kind of care. But it has to do with the financial and sort of political encumbrances that we're running into, I think.
I think you're exactly right, Mike. It really is about the, you know, this is the ultimate example of necessity is the mother of invention. And, you know, the idea that community paramedicine is a new thing and we're just investigating that in the continental U.S., you've been doing that for 25 years, and it's a standard part of your practice, and it works beautifully, and it's been refined quite well, and it's quite honestly a model for the rest of the country to follow. I think it makes tremendous sense to do that, and you guys are a resource entity for how to approach a community paramedicine model. You've been doing it for a very long time. It's worked very effectively.
Well, you know, in full disclosure, I can take no ownership of it. I'm just been a passive person way off to the side, but I've been humbled by how good a job they've done with this.
To me, that's a huge part of the plus of it. It's worked very well. It's been in place for many years, and it's been very effective. So, you know, I think the idea that we need to justify community paramedicine and do a lot of pilot studies to prove that it's cost effective and it makes sense, et cetera, are somewhat absurd. It's been done. It's been done a long time ago. We simply need to be implementing these programs and moving these processes forward.
Couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. I might also share with you some anecdotes if you'd like to hear them, just a couple of stuff we've done up here. I don't know.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Well, I always like to think back on what had to be the most genteel air disaster that's ever happened on the planet, which I was part of. I was an attending physician for that, and we had an airliner. This is back in the mid-90s, as I recall. It was China Air, I think, and they were flying over our airspace, and the I think it was a 747, whatever it was, large aircraft, large capacity crowd on it, it dropped about 10,000 feet and then pulled up. So they had this major incident. I saw the pictures later on where everything in all the luggage bins and stuff had kind of let loose, and I think the floorboards came up a bit just due to this, you know, this huge deceleration when they actually regained control of this aircraft that was plummeting. So we got a call that we were going to have a disaster, but the aircraft had managed to land at Chimia, out on the Aleutian chain, which was about maybe 2.5 hours by C-130 to us. So that's why I said it was just the most genteel disaster ever. We knew we were getting about 240 souls from an aircraft event, but we were going to get them in about 2.5 hours. And we had a couple of criticals, and we had a lot of walking wounded. And we had one obstetrician, who was the only person on the island. I believe it was Shimmy. It was one of our Aleutians. And I believe there's a submarine base there. Anyway, there was military personnel, but the only physician on scene was an obstetrician. And he was, of course, backboards were all the rage back then, so they were taking all the plywood off buildings and making backboards out of them and sending us these boatloads of these C-130s of patients periodically. They were all Chinese-speaking, and we had all the interpreters come from the embassy and somehow got all these people rallied. So we had almost an interpreter per patient as these, you know, 20 and 30, 40 people were coming in. We had the surgeons all lined up for who needed to get surgery. And then, quite honestly, as opposed to perhaps me being raised in the environment I was, you know, and have my hair on fire and demanding attention, this was the most calm and orderly group of human beings I'd ever seen. They were like they're getting ready to go to a tour of the Vatican. They were just sitting there kind of bloodied up or bruised or whatever, and they very, 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 very orderly as we tried to address their injuries and the like. So I don't know if that's of interest, but it was an unusual thing. It was as if a person had had an airline problem in California and needed to come to Minnesota to get it looked at.
That's a great story, Mike. I mean, I think that's once again one of those instances where the insertion of a time delay in many of those things makes a huge difference in how those processes flow. and what the outcomes are, and how the operational aspects of that thing go. So that was a wonderful story. I love that.
Me too. That was fascinating. So I guess it would be safe to assume that a lot of the MCI type issues you have are probably related to aircraft down or that kind of thing.
Yeah, they are. I mean, still vehicular trauma. You know, in the villages, people do have vehicles and short road patches to use them on. But so much of the stuff does go back to aircraft when we have true MCIs, and then we get a lot of blunt trauma injuries from ATVs and snow machines.
Imagine. So how do you handle training these people that are so far out there? How do you keep them up and running and licensed and certified and fresh on their skills? Not that they're not using them all the time, but that does create kind of a problem. When they're
well,
so far away.
My biggest experience, of course, is with the medics and nurses that flew for me. And so we had a lot of intense training, you know, periodically, because we were taking them from urban to rural and back again. And so there was a lot of training involved and a lot of feedback with regard to missions we'd flown. With regard to the people that are out in the villages, I think that is a huge problem. I think it's the same with any sort of big system, and it's the same with urban systems, too, in terms of providing training for low-frequency, high-acuity events and how you keep people trained and ready to handle that kind of thing. I don't have an answer for that. It's just
you do the best you can. Well, call Joe. He'll come on up there and help you out. Right,
yeah,
Joe?
You know, I have a great job as an EMS physician. And I'm sure if the EMS physicians tune into this, they must feel the same. I mean, I get to stand on the shoulders of heroes all the time, and mostly I'm in a pretty comfortable situation when they're not. One of the groups that I've, a bunch of heroes that, I mean, and the word is overused, but honestly, in this situation, I think not. The pararescue men, and that was not used incorrectly. I don't know that we have any pararescue women. We certainly have a lot of support staff and women on the team. But the kinds of things they've done up here in Alaska, it's astounding. And if it's okay with you guys, I might tell you at least one or two stories about how the pararescue team operates up here.
I think that would be great.
So just as a background, the pararescue, also called parajumpers, they have multiple missions. I don't want to say I understand it all. I've been around the guys for a couple of decades now, I guess, and I've been honored to kind of sit in their presence and fly around from a little bit. But their main mission is to go in and rescue downed flyers. In the Anchorage area, their defined mission is to be here for what was our F-15 squadron. Now it's F-22s. And any time that the F-15s were in the air, those guys were in position to get up and do a rescue if those guys had to punch out of their fighter aircraft. And they get stationed around the globe. It's kind of interesting when we were doing space launches, these guys would be in somewhere in Africa. They'd be shipped there, and they would sit just for that moment when the space shuttle was in an area over Africa in which if the shuttle failed and they deployed the rescue pod, these guys would be there to take them. It was a period of just, you know, a minute and a half, and it took them a week to get there and get positioned. So in Alaska, they expanded to an urban search and rescue role. And so we still have four PAVHAWK aircraft, which is a Black Hawk. Has other capabilities, I'm sure, but it has an air refuel probe on it. So this is that aircraft you may have seen, and other aircraft have it too. On the right skid, there's this projection from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things, they saddle up behind a C-130 tanker and take on fuel. So that goes from having a situation where, you know, you have a helicopter that's got a radius of, say, 150 miles. Now you've got a helicopter that's got a lot of legs, because we'll send a C-130 up and send the PAVHAWK after it, and those guys can pump them gas and get them a lot further out. When the PJs go out and fly a mission, they'll fly it with dry suits, parachutes, climbing gear, and often an inflatable raft that they can kick out of the aircraft. I don't know if you have something. I actually know that you've got PJ squadrons down there. I know there's one in Tennessee, and there's a number of others as well. I don't know if you guys work with the PJs at all.
Yeah, I just did at Air Force Shields, yeah. But it was ground training. It wasn't anything that they were really doing, but I really enjoyed them. They're very fascinating guys with a lot of knowledge and experience.
So one of the things that they do is that they will, we have a thing called a Ram-Z, which is a palletized Zodiac. And so the Zodiac gets folded up into basically a plywood box. The transom is folded up. It's got some outboard engines on it, nitrogen tanks to pump up the chambers in the Zodiac, gas goes. Anyhow, they go over the mission site. They kick the Ram-Z. It's got two chutes on it. The loadmaster kicks it out of the back of the C-130. And then the PJs with sport chutes jump in after it and follow it down and hit pretty close to where it hits in the water, and they unpack it, blow up the chambers, and fire it up, and they're off running if everything goes the way it should. So that, to me, is kind of an interesting way to approach a problem. And if you have a minute, I'll tell you about one case in particular that was kind of interesting, the mission we flew.
Go ahead.
So in rescue medicine, you know, you know what you know, but you don't know as much as you'd like to know. And so this was a situation in which there was a freighter out in the Bering Sea, which if you just think of a long way from wherever you are, go a little bit further, you'll get there. And so the PJs were asked through the Rescue Command Center to Rescue Coordination Center to fly this mission because there was a sick diabetic on the vessel. There was significant language barriers. The PJs flew for certainly several hours out to the Bering Sea. They identified the vessel in question. They kicked out the Ram-Z. The guys jump in after it, you know, and parachute down and get the thing fired up, and they chug over to the vessel. And I envision something like a Jacob's Ladder going down, and they get themselves on this big freighter. And then they run down the below deck, and the so-called diabetic is this bloated dead guy who has an air compressor hose in his gullet that the captain's been forcing air into because he probably had a cardiac arrest about a day or two prior, and they thought it was a diabetic problem. So the guys bid the crew well. The crew, incidentally, was in shock because what they encountered was one of the PJs, who usually spends his summers up on Mount McKinley, had black hands and a black face. He otherwise was a real white boy. And he peeled off his dry suit. And so they saw this terrifying figure of a black-faced, black-hand white man in his underwear kind of proceeding over to take a look at the patient. So that was kind of, I thought, sort of the amusing sidebar. And otherwise was an interesting sort of communication issue. There you go.
Great picture. I could just imagine.
But, I mean, I think that the underlying thing here is when, and I hear this theme throughout the discussion tonight, Mike, is that it's the underlying education, training, and background of the people in these remote areas, whether it's your parajumpers or it's your your remote community health aides. It comes down to the training and the education they've received, and that makes the difference often when you get into these remote, austere situations.
Absolutely. That's one thing. And, I was just kind of reflecting on the fact that so many of these things are sort of one-offs. You know, it's a matter of weather, time of day, resources at the scene. And so, quite honestly, many of these become community efforts. I would say more often than not, they're community efforts in terms of figuring out what the best way is to get a person from point A to point B. An airplane might be desirable, but the weather's too bad, so they'll use somebody's fishing boat to get the person over to a place where a landing strip has lights, because not all of our landing strips have lights. So there's this whole interplay of the community that feeds into it as well.
Wow. I think it's safe to say that anybody that works in Alaska would be bored to death being anywhere else. series.
Yeah, definitely.
I know a lot of people like it up here. You know, it is a unique environment. There's no question about it. And there are big challenges out there.
Well, you know, Joe, you know, just thinking about it, it seems like it comes back to what we've been talking about here on the show time after time, week after week, that it really comes down to the specialized education and training that people get in the field and utilize that knowledge to take care of patients in very difficult and unusual situations. And that's one of the things I think you guys do a good job with at Paragon, is bringing that, and you know, the unique experience of your education team, your training team, in to relay some of these specialized situations to your class so that they can take that knowledge and take it back to their area and be ready for that once in a lifetime event, which in Alaska is more common than most people are likely to experience down here in the lower 48.
Oh, I think you're dead on target, Jamie. I was just thinking the same thing. To some extent, we just need to send people to Alaska for a couple of months, and it would be the same as having Paragon come and do a class for them in disaster medicine, because clearly they do it every day.
Definitely. Mike, you know, it's great to have you on the show, and we could probably sit here and chat about this stuff all night long, but we've got to wrap this up at some point or another. We'll make sure that we get in touch with you. If people have any questions, we'll forward those questions on to you. We get questions from time to time from the audience, and we encourage them to do so if you'd be willing to respond back.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Joe, where can folks find you?
They can find me and Paragon on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or paragonmededu on Twitter. We're also on Facebook.
Excellent. Sam, how about you?
Well, hopefully you'll find me in Alaska someday soon, because now I really want to go back there. So maybe I'll go visit Mike. But for the moment, you'll find me on the usual social media places, Sam Bradley on Facebook, Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, and certainly at the DisasterPodcast.com website. And you can't tell me you people don't have questions about this, because I have 1,000 more that I hope we can maybe have Mike entertain us some other time and ask those questions. But in the meantime, feel free to ask them on the website. Jamie?
Yeah, and you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most places on social media sites. And like Sam said, over at DisasterPodcast.com, where we want you to get in touch with us. You can leave a comment on the episode that you're listening to and leave that comment, and it'll email us and let us know that there's a comment there. And if you have a question or a comment or a suggestion, whatever the case may be, you need to make this part of your community effort here. We like to hear from the audience, and we use your suggestions for where we go in future episode topics. So it's important, if you want to hear more of Mike and you want to hear more of the stories out of what's going on in remote and austere care in Alaska, well, we can certainly arrange for that. And we want to let you know that too. And Mike's graciously agreed to join us, at least to answer some questions by email or whatever, so we can take those emails or questions from you and get the answers back from him, and we'll answer them here in a future episode based on what his responses are. And Mike, again, thanks very much for being on the show tonight.
Thanks. Great talking with you. Appreciate it.
You know, Sam, I think Alaska has underlined everything we've talked about with regard to disaster medicine.
Oh, my God, more so than probably any episode we've ever done that shows that remote medicine, austere medicine, and disaster medicine are not our everyday medicine.